I usually walk around, but I guess I'm trapped here at the desk. So, but, thank you for coming. This is a interesting but very specialized topic because a mega shelter, as you'll see, I'll answer the question of what it is and what it does and so forth, is a very specific building for a very specific purpose. And I really don't have anything to disclose. That's a mega shelter. And it's a big building. And it is adjacent to the LSU Alexandria campus, so it's in a highly agricultural area that's outside of Alexandria. Now, Alexandria is a curious place for this because that's a city of 50,000. And we only have two hospitals, each 250 beds each. So it is not an area of high medical density. And this will fit into this story as we move along. Now, where did it come from? Well, it came from Katrina. And there were funds available for construction originally of three of these permanent shelters. And to my knowledge, there may be one other one in the United States, but this is not a common deal to have a dedicated building for sheltering. So it was, you know, planned and constructed, and there was a $27 million budget to build three, and by the time they finished this one, they had spent all $27 million. So, we have a very nice, expensive building there. So, it has been used. It was used in Gustav and Ike. I won't talk too much about that because it was actually open before it had been inspected. And so, there were some adventures in what happened there, which you really don't need to know about. But it did get a baptism by fire or by water. But we also used it for Isaac. Now, that's the floor plan. This building is 200,000 square feet. So this is a big deal, a big building. And the sections there, I'll talk a little bit about the sections, because this was actually a building that was constructed for the purpose of sheltering. And so there were a lot of design aspects that went into that that are quite unique. So it has an entrance there where the buses come under and you can unload folks. It has a big loading dock on the back where you can put merchandise or MREs or whatever you want to pull in there. That's where folks get unloaded. It has metal detectors so that when at the reception area, when you come through, you go through a metal detector. There's tubs there that you throw your, you know, arms in and knives and stuff. And you'll see that there's a little catwalk up there, and you'll see that elsewhere because there's a mezzanine, sort of a second floor there, and there's a catwalk that runs all the way around so that armed guards can patrol at any time and see everything in the building except the bathrooms. So that's something you won't see in a normal building. In fact, we had one person come up recently, says, "I think I'm in a prison." Well, it's not exactly that way. So there's a registration area, and this is manned by our Department of Children and Family Services because, as Dr. Guidry said, this is not a one-group operation. This is a big, complicated thing with lots of moving parts. We have a little medical clinic. So we have an eight-bed medical clinic and a reception area for that. There's a pharmacy loading dock where an 18-wheeler that's fully stocked pharmacy can come up and open up. The only problem is we don't have a truck that has an 18-wheeler pharmacy in it. But it's there. So our section, the Office of Public Health section of this, is where we establish a medical special needs shelter. You know, this is for folks that have qualified for that part. And that's what it looks like. And this thing is set up in permanence. So there are 450 beds there. Now, the Office of Public Health can man 200 of those. We have the manpower to accommodate 200 beds there. And the other part will be for a federal medical station. And in Gustav, we actually coexisted and commingled and worked on the same patients, which I don't think has ever been done before or since, frankly. And I'll tell you why. It has bathrooms, big bathrooms that run through the center that handicapped people can get in and out of. There's a storage room. So we have all of our supplies, and we're set up so that we can be set up in 2 hours. Now, that's a very precious thing, because no other fix, if you don't have a fixed site, of course, you can't do that. There's these limitations to what, you know, what you can do. There's a back section that's used for supplies, because there wasn't really a section for supplies. And then there's two dormitories on the upstairs, and each one accommodates 44 people. So who do you think gets the dormitories? No, the people with guns. We let the state police and National Guard have that because they have guns. So, and it is a problem because 44, how many people do you think it takes to run a shelter that has a 3,000 person capacity? Any guesses? None? No guesses? 400, about 400 people. So you're not going to stick 400 people up there. So either they're going to have to stay, you know, on cots, you know, in special sections, or what we did, that's 426 was the estimate, and that may vary, but that's if everybody, all those different agencies are working there. So the campus is not far from there, so we actually have a fitness center over there, which is dedicated to 250, you know, beds, so that those folks are bused back and forth, and those are personnel. That's not the evacuees. There's a security center so that they know what's going on everywhere at all times. There's there's lockers. This is a very complex thing because distributing keys and getting them back turns out to be logistically almost impossible. And then, so that's our part. That's the medical special needs part. The other part is the critical transportation needs shelter part. We can accommodate, you know, 450 people, more or less. This part, you can put 2,500. And these are people that are bused in. This isn't a general population shelter. This is the folks that have been picked up in South Louisiana and shipped to us. That's the room itself. And you see the catwalk that runs by? So that allows 24-hour security so that you don't have things happen that supposedly happen in the Superdome. That's what it looks like when it's all set up. Now, it's not normally set up. It's normally just empty. So the Department of Children and Family Services has to come in and put this thing up. And there are various estimates about how long it takes, but it takes a while. Because they were mandated to do it in 6 hours, but I think 18 hours later they were still working on it. I mean, there's just limitations in how fast you can go. So that's what it looks like. And it's divided into those two sections, and one of the sections is a family section, and there's actually a wall, a little low cement wall there, because this part can actually be used for rodeos. It's a multi-purpose section. Because otherwise this building, you know, can just sit there. And it was recently used for the state fair successfully. But along there, folks set up for children's areas, for like a daycare type thing, and it's well organized. There's serveries. There's no cooking on site. All the food is brought in, it's already been prepared, or it's MREs. So there's not really a kitchen, because the standards for that would be enormous. But there are, you know, there's a distribution center, there's a back entrance, and the reason I'm even showing it is that the major part of this is critical transportation needs. So that means people don't drive up to this. They're driven up in a bus, and that bus goes off someplace else and parks. But our section, we are mandated to receive drive-ups as well, as long as they satisfy criteria for a medical special needs shelter. So individuals and small ambulances and so forth will come in the back, and we have a separate triage station there. It has its own water tanks. It has AC units. It has a giant generator that took several years to get there, but it got there. The little one's in the back. And the problem with that is it would only work the emergency electricity, but it wouldn't run the air conditioning. And if you've ever been in Louisiana in hurricane season, that's not good. It has two helipads for flying sick people or politicians in and out. And then, of course, there was an allusion to pets. And pets is a really big deal because after Katrina, they passed the Pet Act. So it's not an option to not take care of people's pets. So adjacent to this building is an agricultural center, and that agricultural center is dedicated to receiving the pets. Now, how does this fit into disaster preparedness? I'm going to skip through these really rapidly because this is really what Dr. Guidry was talking about. But statewide, we can accommodate 11,500 critical transportation needs and 1,640 medical special needs. And that's where we're located. That's our part of this big thing. The critical transportation needs shelters, there are several of them. That's the same place that Dr. Guidry showed. And we actually have two sites for federal medical stations, so we can accommodate up to 750. But 250 are at a different site. So we're a receiving. We're not a impact area. We're a sheltering area. So all of those southern places there, they have a complex system of registration. So people are supposed to come to pick up points and then be registered. So people aren't just hopping on the buses. They're supposed to be registered. Now, that's when it's done in an orderly fashion. And because of our capacity, these pickup points are located in different places, and different folks come to different shelters. So that's the Union Pacific train station. These people are triaged there. They're put on buses there. They're triaged at LSU, Baton Rouge, and then they end up, some of them, at our place. And it's all a big deal, and there's ways where pets go, and there are ways where people go, but it's all, well organized. And then there's a sequence of fill depending on the numbers so that you fill us first and then you go up to Shreveport where Oklahoma comes down and helps them take care of folks there. There is a gentleman from Oklahoma here. Okay. And it doesn't, the capacity, there's all these host agreements because the state simply can't absorb the number of people. If there was a full evacuation, it just can't. And so there's these complex a memoranda of understanding and so forth, which change often, apparently. And I think Oklahoma has an agreement to come down and staff or assist with the shelters in Shreveport rather than sending people to them. So these things vary from place to place. So the pets get registered just like people. They have a special place where they go there. If they're in big cages, they go in big cages. If they're small animals, if they can sit in your lap, they can go in your lap. Yeah, but they're all registered. So they go up to they go to the pet shelter, the people go to our shelter, and then they can go back and forth. And when we evacuated for Isaac, only one dog, what was his name? Snoopy. Only one Snoopy got put up to Shreveport when his owner was in Alexandria. But that's not bad, only one dog. So we need all these partners and so forth. And I'm not going to dwell on this, except it turns out that when you're dealing with a lot of different people, there's federal people, there's state people, there's different agencies, there's private folks, that your command and control structures and cooperation can be very, very tricky. So these are some of our stakeholders. Those are government partners. Those are community partners. This is some people may recognize it, Robert Woods Johnson partner tool, where you put in your partners and they calculate, relationships. And it's a free tool. And we did this for the Office of Public Health in our area. This is just Region 6. And those are all those relationships. So it's quite complicated. And of course, it all starts with that. We all form our EOCs. We're over there, that little deal over there of public health. And that's the EOC organizational structure. So that picture that Dr. Guidry showed you of all those people in the pit, well, that's what they're doing. And everybody's answering to somebody. And that's Governor's Office of Homeland Security, Emergency Preparedness. You have all this stuff. You have all your ESFs. And then you have your Bureau of Emergency Medical Services. And then you have federal assets. Now, these people get called in if we just can't handle the whole deal. And and they were called in. Lots were called in Katrina, and they were also called in Gustav Eich, and they will co-locate with us or do something. But they don't have the same command structure. So they will be on site, but they don't answer to me as the incident commander for the medical the special needs shelter, even if they're there. And so they answer up through this IRCT business, and as long as everybody gets along, it's fine. If you don't happen to get along, it's not so nice. And we didn't have any problems. It was all copacetic, but it was not the universal experience. And it has to do with these command structures that follow different routes. That's the DMATs and so forth. So even though I was like, I'm not... The actual incident, there is no incident commander for the whole shelter. It's actually a unified command. But the person who runs is the shelter manager from Department of Children and Family Services. It's actually like the facilitator. And that's the only way we could figure out to run that so that it wasn't total chaos. Because you couldn't go from group to group and have everybody leading the show. We have these volunteers that you already saw about that. Then getting people in is one problem. Getting them back out is another problem. Who decides that? When does it get decided? And as Dr. Guidry alluded to, a lot of politics can come into play in those decisions, even though they're planned ahead. There's a very elaborate reentry plan where the parishes, receiving parishes, have to, tell all the services they have, and when all that turns green, then people can go back. Well, does this work? I mean, this was all the theory. So here's the practice. And the practice was, the most recent one was Isaac. So Isaac comes barreling in there and drops a ton of water. And as Dr. Guidry said, this was not anticipated. So were we able to bring the people to pick up stations and register them and do all that, the thing we're supposed to do? Yes or no?
No.
No. We weren't able to do that because this was more like a search and rescue modality than it was a organized evacuation. I mean, it was organized, but not in the same way. So there was a ton of water. So what this was it was like a mini Katrina. And you had the same kinds of folks with their bags and their clothes wet and, getting on the bus. So it was just like that, but smaller scale. So you had a lot of people. So what happened? So we get activated. We have a shelter staff. On Wednesday, October 29, 2012, Laplace floods. And so they get buses in there, and they send 50 buses in there to evacuate the people that needed assisted evacuation. So from one day to the next, we get 1,000 shelteries by bus. A few more the next day, we get some drive-ups, we get everything. So we end up having about 2,000 people come into the shelter. So it was, it was really open. So 600 drive-ups, 1,000 critical transportation needs. And when they did the numbers, it was really actually higher than this. I'm not exactly sure how that happened. But the total number of evacuees were about 3,700. And 1,900 of those, 37, showed up at our critical transportation needs shelter. And we shared some with, and then some went to Juela. So these buses arrive in the middle of the night. They always come in the middle of the night. And you've got 50 buses, and they're coming in there, and then you have to decide who's, and they were supposed to be a certain number that are coming to us and a certain number going to Alexandria, and of course on the road they all get mixed up, so when they just said, you take the first 25, and that's how Snoopy got lost, but, and that's not too bad. So we got our patients, and then they drove on up to Shreveport. So it worked out pretty well. That was our medical special needs shelter. And the fact is, based on the numbers, we had less people in the medical special needs than you would anticipate. Why do you think that happened? Because just given the numbers of people and the number of evacuees, we didn't even reach our 200 capacity. Any ideas? Well, we're the only place where the medical special needs and the critical transportation needs shelters are co-located. So many of the people who would qualify for medical special needs chose to stay with their families on the critical transportation needs side. Now that's all well and good, except that we're still responsible for the medical care for all of them. So, what did we do? So, this is really the practical nitty-gritty of this. You know, this is why I think you might get something out of this. So we had this big mass of people, and we established a first aid station on the side of the critical transportation needs. And that was manned by EMS. And the EMS people are very competent, and they can handle tons of things. And so they were there 24 hours a day, and they would do blood pressures, and they would do breathing treatments, and test glucose, and so forth. Now, there's a lot of things they can't do, but what's one principal thing they can't do for these people that are up here for, you know, 7 days who haven't brought their medications? They have no prescriptive authority. So what we did was we had volunteers from the local family practice residency, of which there's only 12 people, and we put those folks over there for sick call. So a certain time during the day, people knew they could go there, and if they had a more complicated problem, they could get prescriptions, they could get taken care of, but they could also get their prescriptions filled. Because there's also a system where you have buses that go to Walmart with people so they can pick up their medications. So that worked fine. Now, there were still sick people. So there were some sick people who were sick enough to get seen by somebody a little higher up. So we had 157 people go to our clinic area, you know, the little area that I showed there. And those folks were seen by one of my two nurse practitioners or myself or sometimes a medical resident. Now, we saw 157 of those people. So how many of those, you see how many went to the hospital? Is that a lot? That's not a lot of people. But 15 were admitted. So what was their level of severity? It was pretty bad. But what happened was we were able to, that was Dr. Kitchell, he came at 3 o'clock in the morning to help me triage people. What we were able to do was to accommodate a very large group of people, many of whom had medical issues. And almost 700 of those were seen in the first aid station. Only 157 were sick enough to actually come back to a clinical area. Only 30 went out to the ER, and only 15 were actually admitted. So were our two area hospitals pleased and surprised? They were delighted because they were expecting 700. So you are able to use the resources that you have, and the result was, pretty good. Now, this is our medical records in there were a little sketchy, but this is just age distribution. So we saw many pediatric patients and a few geriatric patients. We did not have a federal medical station or disaster medical assistance team because this all happened very rapidly, and by the time, you know, all that can get organized, they were really sent elsewhere, essentially. We did have a very robust community response. So we went on the television and said, we have all these people, they're all wet, they don't have any clothes, and David Britt, because at a community level, you know all these people. David Britt gets on, goes on his Facebook or whatever and says, bring clothes to the mega shelter. And then by the next day, we had one of those hanger deals full of clothes. So, but these are all because of connections at a local level. You know, the medical school, the United Way, it's all local stuff. Environmental Health, I saw Teeny Sibley here. They came by and they have to oversee shelters, and so they did their inspections. So, I'm not too bad here. So, what's the secret of this? The secret's the three C's. You got to have collaboration, you got to have coordination, and you got to communicate. And it doesn't matter if it's Oklahoma or Nebraska or the Philippines or wherever, and you'll hear it over and over again with all sorts of deals. You also need partners, and you need planning. So, and partners and collaboration are not necessarily the same thing. Most of ours are very collaborative. And then, Dr. Kidd, you also alluded to this. You got to be flexible because it never happens the way you really plan. And that's it. So, any questions? I guess Dr. Guidry can come up.
Questions, please. Yes, ma'am.
I'll just repeat the question. She's asking if we had a plans prior to Katrina for moving hospital patients with the ambulances and Department of Defense. 2 weeks before Katrina, we had a drill. What would happen if New Orleans were to get flooded? And at that time, discussion at that tabletop was, how are we going to move people out of hospitals? How are we going to move them out of harm's way? And at the time, the federal government was planning with us said, we probably have to activate NDMS, National Disaster Medical System. And I said, well, have you ever done that before? And the answer was no. They were telling me what I could ask for, but they weren't telling me how to get that done because they had never done that before to this magnitude. So what we had a plan for prior to Katrina was how to move people. And what was understood was that people that are going to be out in the water are going to be a top priority. So that someone's in a hospital, they're above water level, they're not going to be the first people that get picked up. And so what you saw occurring is people were being picked out of trees and rooftops, and the people at the hospitals were bagging people in 100 degrees, no air, no air conditioning, and patients decompensating. But the first priority was getting people out of water and then get over to the hospitals and get people moved out of the hospital. That was a very sophisticated plan, which we used, which was to go from an area of water to an area of high ground. And you don't know what that's going to be until you see where the water settles. And so we had plans for, which we called them lily pads. People would be brought to a lily pad, kind of like a frog jumps over to the lily pad, where it was drier, and from there be taken somewhere else. So we had plans on moving people from hospitals through water, all these plans. But the resources, the number of ambulances it takes, the number of boats it takes, that had not been sketched out. And all those things showed up. And like I said, we moved 12,000 people in 4 days. And it was like never been done before and phenomenal. But that didn't make it in the news. What made it in the news were people stranded at the convention center and at the Superdome, which is horrible. I'm not downplaying that. But there was a lot of movement that came post-storm because we had not brought in the assets to move people. So we didn't have the number of ambulances. We didn't have the number of boats. We didn't have the number of buses till several days after the event. So to answer your question, the plans were there, but the resources weren't.
I'll just tell you our experience. First of all, it is extremely stressful because you should go under these 12-hour shifts, which are usually 18 or 20 or whatever.
Dr. Dave, can you repeat your question?
Oh, I'm sorry. The question was really about behavioral health implications for the workers and the workers of Office of Public Health and what happens to them and how you accommodate all that. Well, I have to say that even though this was very stressful and stressful for people's families, I didn't have one nurse that did not show up. Never. I had nobody who said they were too sick or too this or too that. And then as soon as we transitioned out of this deal, we go, all this work's been accumulating at the health units because it's the same nurses, They all went back to their jobs, and nobody called in sick and so forth. So, you know, I wish I was responsible for, you know, being so kind and gentle that they were all happy. But really, honestly, they did it. There was no questions, and they were very resilient, let's put it that way. There are plans, you know, because we have behavioral health on site. And so if somebody really has a meltdown, then there are folks on site from behavioral health that can actually take care of them. That happened to clients. It did not happen to healthcare providers.
Other questions? Yes, sir.
I think your question, and correct me if I'm wrong, was that the experiences in Region 6 at Alexandria were not the same experiences that had in this region, which is Region 1. And that's true, because this region is an impacted area, and they're trying to get out of harm's way. But in Isaac, they stayed because it was a tropical storm, and what's supposed to be a lot of water like showed up. And so people stayed, and so we had different issues here, because people were without electrical power. They were in high-rise buildings, especially the elderly. They were in 100-degree heat without electrical power. What we did, we actually used a federal medical station that we opened at the convention center to take in medical special needs. We came here after the storm because people couldn't go back to their homes. They could, the ones that were real sick. So it was a very different experience here, but a receiving parish like Region 6 has a totally different experience than a parish that's trying to get out of harm's way. And if you stay, then we all have a different experience. Every event that we talked about today has been a different experience, which is what requires the flexibility. Whether you stay in place, whether you move, who's leaving, who's staying, how do you dress. I had a nursing home that we moved in Isaac. We moved it to a meet because they lost power and these elderly, frail people were getting in trouble. Well, where we moved them to was a nursing home that, because of the storm, a dam was about to break and was about to flood the nursing home. I had to move those people back. I mean, it's unbelievable the kind of things that if you don't anticipate, they're going to happen. And flexibility is the name of the game. But you're right, the experience is very different. If people are having mental health issues, this can tip them over. It becomes a huge deal for people that are, you know, they're struggling with day-to-day life, and all of a sudden the rug's pulled out from under them. They've got to leave town. They don't have funding. They don't have a way to travel. They know the Katrina experience, so you can actually elevate or escalate behavioral health problems in a region as a result of an event like this, which all goes into what we deal with on the receiving end, because then we have to deal with these folks coming and decompensating by the time we receive them.
Other questions? Yes, ma'am.
If I understand the question, how would I compare the relationship between those that work for us and those that come to help us, or?
Well, the dependability of being able to follow them at
the difference, in my opinion, and we spend a lot of time on contracts to try to bring in help, because things have really changed since Katrina, where we have a lot more folks willing to come, but there's a price to pay. So you don't have near the volunteerism we used to have. So what you see is that the ability to have command and control over employees that you can set up that shelter in 2 hours, whereas a contractor might take 2 days to get there. So we know what we have in hand, and that is my biggest fear, is that if the storm spins up quickly in the Gulf and we don't have the time to get our resources, that we're going to do it. We're still going to do it, but we're going to do it with a lot less resources. So we have the ability to ramp up. We have the scalability, but the time is the point which you don't control. A hurricane can be here in 72 hours, or it can be here in 12. So you literally, you know, no notice like a tornado or a earthquake, you can't really prepare that much for. You can respond and react to what occurs, but a hurricane gives you some time, so you can have no excuse for not being ready. But sometimes it's not enough time. So we're racing the clock with moving people. And so having employees that work with you and understand the plan, you can ramp up and have that initial push. But if it's a big push and the help that's coming doesn't show up, then you're going to be doing a lot of the work on the back end of an event. And that part's the scary part, because we all know we'd have to do so much more work if we don't get the extra help.
Super presentation. We're just privileged to have you to come here and to hear about your experiences. Thank you so much. It was just wonderful.
Thank
and thank you for all for coming.
Yeah.